Welcome to the Om Show. I'm your host, Om Malik. I am today talking to Tony Hill, founder and CEO of Scroll, which is wants to be the Spotify of media, of news media. And before that, he was the founder, CEO of Chartbeat, and an interesting guy who's not shy of his opinions when it comes to media. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, Om. It's great to be here.
So did I pronounce your name right, Tony Hale, or is it Tony Hale?
It's Tony Hale, although I get highly hell, all kinds of things usually.
So, you know, you and I have been friends for a long time, and I've always enjoyed your, strong opinions about the media industry and how it is messing up. And I thought it would be great to have a little conversation, especially in the light of current events. You know, you had a lot of companies, whether it is Little Things, Vox, BuzzFeed, many of those companies have hit air pockets, you know, in 2018. And I thought it would be an ideal time to discuss their fate and what happens to digital media, especially the new digital media companies. But before we do that, I want to know a little bit more about you. You know, since every time I meet you, we all end up talking about media and what's happening in media, but I never really get to know more about you as a person. Tell me, where are you from and what's been your journey so far from where you were to where you are now? And don't take too many words. I know you British people like to talk too much.
Sure. So I was born and raised in London, although I've spent the last 10 years in New York, which means that my accent has kind of morphed into this Anglo-American thing, which where everyone thinks that I'm Australian. I started out, came out of university and did what everyone does, which is competed in a round-the-world yacht race and was a bowman there. So I stood at the pointy end and got the shit kicked out of me. Then got back to dry land, 9/11 happened, and I went off to a kind of private intelligence agency for a couple of years, and then led polar expeditions for 4 years or so before finding my way into startups. The first startup was an utter disaster, which I was fired from after launching a coup against the CEO. The second startup was a company called Chartbeat, which is still going strong, and where I spent about 7 years. And now I am a CEO of Scroll, which I co-founded with two great friends of mine to see if we could find something where a press could be thriving and sustainable, because we thought that was important for democracy, and where user experience on the web could be better.
So tell me a little bit more about that around the world yacht race. Like, how did that come about and why?
So, to be honest, I've thought about this a lot. The reasons why I would go and choose to do something like that. And the weird thing is that all the reasons that I've come up with for why I would go and do something so ridiculous, I came up with after I made the decision to do it. And so all I can say is this: it was, I was sitting, and it was my second year of university, and I was sitting in a library and I read about a race that was going to happen in a few years' time. And something just in me said, I'm going to do that. And so I started learning how to sail properly. I'd done a little bit before. I spent my summers working on boats, delivering boats across the Atlantic, was lucky enough to be selected for a crew. And then in September 2000, I sailed out from Southampton and went from Southampton to Boston, to Buenos Aires, around Cape Horn, to Wellington, to Sydney, to Cape Town, to La Rochelle, and then back to Southampton. It was about 10 months and 36,000 miles of sailing, all against the prevailing winds and currents. So it was pretty bumpy.
Yeah. Why is it that all Englishmen always want to get away from England?
Probably a kind of conflicted relationship with our families.
What does that mean? Elaborate.
No, I'm just joking. I think that, like, there's something in the kind of British culture, which you may be familiar with, of us always wanting to go and try and conquer things. And the oceans was something there. There was also, I think for me anyway, there was a deep sense of being unfinished, of having gone through an amazing university experience, but having learned predominantly kind of how to pour and drink drinks, and a little bit about international relations. And I thought this would be the kind of thing that would toughen me up a little bit. And it certainly did. I learned more from those 10 months on the deck of a racing yacht than I did at any other point in my life. It was incredible.
So you, what college were you in?
I went to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, the home of golf, and subsequently the University of Prince William, who dragged the cachet of the place down a little bit, but increased the female-to-male ratio by quite a substantial percentage.
Well, that can't be all bad.
No, it was an amazing place. It's a beautiful place. Even if you don't like golf, I highly recommend going to St. Andrews.
I mean, come on, it's Scotland. You cannot knock Scotland. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
and at least on television, it looks amazing.
It's true. It's because they film on the days when the weather is good.
Yeah, you guys are so picky about weather. I don't understand that.
It's our national topic of conversation.
100 plus degrees for like most of your life. Then you realize that you will never complain about rain ever again.
That is almost certainly true.
I think we all like to complain about a lot of things. So, you know, you moved to New York. Why?
So I came originally on a tourist visa looking for money for a polar expedition. Because Americans have such a different perspective when you told them about a crazy thing like this. Like British people, when you said you wanted to go to the North Pole or go to the South Pole or something, would say, well, you're asking for a tremendous amount of money and didn't someone just do that last week? Whereas in America, people would go, oh my God, that is the most amazing thing I've ever heard, and you're not even asking for that much money. So I came over, that's my bad American accent, I'm sorry. I came over looking for money for a polar expedition. And whilst I was here, a friend of a friend sent me a business plan for a startup because he knew that I was kind of a closet geek. And he asked me for my opinion. And me being opinionated, as you well know, I wrote 6 pages of notes about why their business plan sucked. I mean, I hadn't really read any business plans before, but this was the worst business plan I'd ever read. And that I thought was just going to a friend, but it got passed around a whole bunch of people. And they came back and said, if you're so smart, why don't you try and run this thing? And I was like, oh, this startup thing sounds fun. I'll do it for a few months until expedition season starts again. And I did it and I fell in love and I never went back.
When you say you were a closet geek, what does that mean? That you like to read comics or collect weird things, or you were actually into computers?
I was kind of more into the philosophy of computers than I was in any way kind of an engineer. I'm an incredibly bad coder at the best of times. But as part of our polar expeditions, we'd had to play around with a lot of tech. We'd had to hack software so that we could make it work over an Iridium network. So we became the first to send back live video from the North Pole. We were working out how we could blog every day from a tent in the middle of the Arctic. And so we'd done a lot of stuff that kind of like got us tangentially into technology. And a lot of the people that we kind of followed on the web and were close with, people like kind of Jason Kotke and Meg Hourihan, kind of like had kind of inspired us and inspired me into kind of enjoying the world of tech and the problems that it was doing. So it was very much kind of an amateur interest at the time, but it was something that I kind of followed.
When you say us, does it mean you had somebody else with
yes.
you, or is it the royal?
No, I'm not quite that posh. For many, many years when I was doing my polar expeditions, I had a teammate, the most incredible man I know, a guy called Ben Saunders. And, it was always our dream actually to go together and do the first ever return journey to the South Pole. Cause no one since Captain Scott tried and died doing it has ever been able to walk from the coast of the Antarctica to the South Pole and back. And so this was our dream. That's what I came to America to raise money for. And I got distracted and he never did. And he continued through setback after setback until a couple of years ago, he was able to embark on the expedition with a good friend of mine, Taka Lebenier. And they were successful. They did the first ever return journey to the South Pole on foot. And I was gobsmacked because I know just how hard that is. So yes, when I talk about us in those days, it was the two of us working together before I had my head turned by the wonder that is the startup world.
So why is it that the British people can do impossible things like that and yet can't play a good game of cricket or win the soccer World Cup?
So like, my theory about us with sports is that in general, the British are very, very good at sports that involve sitting down. So we're very good at cycling, we're good at sailing, we're good at rowing, we're good at dressage, kind of horsemanship. So as long as we can sit down, we're pretty good at sport. It's when you ask us to get up that we really have a problem. So that's why we suck at cricket and pretty much everything else.
You just walked all the way, like your friend just walked all the way to the South Pole and back. I mean, there was no sitting involved in that. And so that kind of, there goes your theory about doing well when sitting down. I think it just is something else. I don't think you guys are team players.
It could be that as well. I think there's something in Lawrence of Arabia, which is kind of one of my favorite films, where Omar Sharif says, it's Alec Guinness says, the English have a hunger for desolate places. And I think that's certainly true. We like seeking out places that are vaguely inhospitable.
Which is kind of funny, given that, you know, England is not that crowded. Like, I mean, England, United Kingdom itself, isn't that crowded compared to, you know, some places I know, like my neighborhood in Devon.
Yeah, I think your average suburb in Northwest London is vastly different. I don't know, dude. We're just weird. We're a weird group of people.
And so you broke free.
Well, like, I kind of broke free, but I work in media in New York City. If there's a place that has got its fair share of Englishmen in that, it's media in New York City.
But look at what you're like. I whenever I've seen you, you wear cowboy boots. I think you've broken free.
There is that. I married a country girl, and I have been to my fair share of country music concerts. And every time that I go home, my friends tease me mercilessly about it.
About what? Like your Americanisms?
Yeah, they think that a British person who wears boots and goes to country music festivals is bizarre.
So you're Richard May of media.
I don't know what I am, dude.
Dude, that's pretty close. Like, he's exactly like you. Then likes country music, drives trucks, you know, wears cowboy clothes. I think you guys are like, you know, soulmates.
Good to know.
But now I heard you just have had a baby, I guess.
She's a little over a year old, and she's fabulous.
So how does that change you as a human being?
So I'll tell you the first thing. So because I've done a lot of kind of ridiculous things in my life, before I did startups, I would often kind of get up on stage and I would talk to people about how to operate in kind of very high risk and stressful environments. And after 3 months of having a kid, I wanted to go back to every single room where I'd ever spoken to an audience and apologize to all the parents in the audience for me not having a clue about what I was talking about. Because I can tell you that, like, working the bow of a racing yacht in the Southern Ocean or navigating a crevasse field in a whiteout, both are way less stressful than dealing with a two-month-old baby. So it's certainly given me a new perspective and a new respect for the quotidian challenges that parents have had to go through over the years. And I certainly sympathize far more with my parents for all the hell I must have put them through.
Really? And so what did your parents do?
My dad was a kind of finance person. My mother is a patent attorney and was for many years at Kodak. There's a strong split in my family between the women in my family are kind of amazing scientists and the men are kind of historians and philosophy geeks and so forth. And so it was always good growing up and having a little bit of both in my life.
And so a little bit of that shifted, right, with you moving to the this side of the pond by marrying your wife, who I believe is a very accomplished author of romance novels.
Yes. If there's one thing that will kind of put you in your place, it's being the husband of a romance novelist. And she's very accomplished. She's a USA Today best-selling author. She's written some 13 novels. And so for 13 books now, I have read exactly what my wife thinks about when she thinks about the kind of perfect man. And none of them look like me, not a single one. So it's definitely a humbling experience.
What about your accent?
My accent, she doesn't hear it anymore, which is the depressing thing, because it's pretty much my only skill.
God, I pity you, man. That's all I can say.
It's your wife.
But I'm sure if you were nice to her, buy her, you know, nice gifts, you know, make sure you clean the house, you know, wash the dishes, cook the food, change the diapers, you can get a bit part in one of her novels.
There was one character which looked like me. He was kind of tall, getting slowly chubby with kind of blonde receding hairline. And he was the evil rapist. So I've just got to do better than that in the next book.
Okay, I think you got work cut out for you. But I think you do really well as a media critic, though. Not to mention you've done really well as a media entrepreneur. You know, what is most refreshing about you is that you're equally self-critical as you are critical about other people and other things. Where does that quality come from?
Say that again.
How are you equal opportunity hater? Like, how did you become one?
I don't think I'm an equal opportunity hater at all. I think that, like, I am. This is an industry that I care so much about. It is so important. I mean, if nothing else, the last year or so has proven the absolute necessity of vitality in this industry. And I'm part of the problem. I also hope to be part of the solution. But I look back over the mistakes that I've made where I could have made more of a difference, or I could have done something. And this industry has a tendency towards inertia. I think generally, if I have a frustration with the industry at all, it's about a willingness to kind of sit in the bleachers too often versus kind of like getting into the arena. But it's these days, it's the relationship of someone who's been married for 10 years to an industry. You know, like, you know each other's faults. You can be open about each other's faults, but there's kind of like this deep abiding love that kind of keeps you there no matter what.
But that's an unevenly applied logic. I think you look at some of the more industrial media, right? The people from the 20th century, right? The Times and some of the publications from that time, from that era, they think differently about change and, you know, embracing change and innovation versus the newer generation of companies, whether it's Vox or BuzzFeed. I think, you know, there's a different way of kind of the inertia is not the same in both in these two camps, in my opinion. At least that's how I feel.
Sure. I mean, I think that you can't easily segment where innovation starts and stops within the industry. I mean, like, I'll tell you that I'm teaching a course on media and technology in Stanford's New York campus. And my students the other day were talking about which media company they'd go and work at. They were all talking about the New York Times and the Washington Post, not because of the brand cachet, not because of the history, but because they felt that these were the publishers where they were doing really exciting new things from a technical standpoint. So I think it's hard to kind of separate those things out, but certainly the kind of digital natives, and we've seen some kind of great ones come of age. They have the luxury in some ways of not having many of the things that which have kind of slowed people down. They don't have a print base to worry about and to fear cannibalizing. They don't often have the same union challenges that can sometimes slow down the pace of things, although that's increasingly becoming a reality now. And there's a whole bunch of places which could do with more union membership as well that are getting those things.
I think we are digressing from the point where I think if your students are telling you that they want to go work for a place like New York Times because of the innovation coming out of there, maybe they should not be in the media. Because if that's what is attracting talent, then you know the change is going to be very hard and very slow to come. I think New York Times, you know, is not a shining example of a digital success story, at least in my opinion. You know, they have, you know, still less than 2% of their online users have converted to paid subscribers.
Sure. So they have 3.6 million subs, I believe. About a million of those are print. About 2.6 are digital on 130 million uniques. So yeah. So the math is broadly right. But if you look at the kind of what happens with subscription in general. Okay, and this is actually a challenge for the broader industry, in that one of the big trends of this year is that everybody in the media space is bringing out their own either subscription or membership plan. The New York Times has done better than anyone else at doing this. So from a transition to a sustainable digital revenue model, they have done better than everyone else. Could they do even more? I'm sure they can. But they're still way ahead of the pack in this way. And I think when my students talk about this, they are thinking more about some of the kind of new things that they're doing around, whether it's kind of the stuff they've been doing around VR or whatever, which are kind of like fun kind of sideshows at the moment, or they're all kind of big fans of The Daily, which has been a huge success. So I think there's kind of interesting things. It's like it's very hard to, and it's very easy to kind of write off publishers, and I can get frustrated with the best of them with any number of different kind of moves that I see being made. But like one of the things that we have to remember is the challenges here are structural. Yeah. It's not necessarily because of incompetence at any one publisher that media is in the kind of straits that it's in today. These are bigger, more systemic problems that media is facing.
Well, I think, you know, these problems have been there forever. It's not like anything recent, and it's not like they have not known about these problems. I think the inaction is telling. Like their inaction and their inability to change fast is very telling. And if the outcome is that they go out of business, so be it. I mean, if you keep, if you're sick and you don't go to the doctor, and you die, that's not on the doctor. That's on you.
That's totally fair. I think there's one great example of that, which was I was at the I think it was a couple of years back now. I was at the Wharton Media Summit, and Craig Newmark, who has spent the last few years really trying to kind of like fund great journalism, he's the founder of Craigslist, was up on stage, and a journalist got up and called him the most principled asshole in technology. And he called him that because he said, when you did Craigslist, you took away all this money from all these newspapers that relied on their classified business, and you didn't even try to work out a way to give that money back to those newspapers, which was the most blinkered, ridiculous statement someone could have made. Because one, it wasn't Craig, it was the internet that did that. But also, when those publications were complaining about Craigslist and trying to kind of keep hold of their classified business, other people were looking at that and seeing the opportunity. So in media itself, you had Shipstead, who said, we can do better than Craigslist. And they built an incredible classified business all around the globe. And even regardless of that, think of the businesses that came out of classifieds that have been built on top of this. You've got Airbnb, you've got Match and Tinder, you've got Zillow, you've got any number of businesses which make billions of dollars, any one of which could have supported an amazing newsroom. And instead, we had this tendency to be like, oh no, we're going to blame that guy instead of working out how we can beat it. So I think that certainly has been a challenge. But at the same time, I wouldn't totally agree with your point that nothing has changed recently. I think that the thing that has really started to kind of accelerate has been the challenge of digital advertising. Digital advertising has always had its problems. But when you have Facebook and Google going from 72% of digital gross spend in 2015 to 77% in 2016, and you see them going towards 87% by 2020, there's a very new dynamic of, I'm no longer competing between other equally sized players for digital advertising on a somewhat level playing field. I am now competing on a vastly lopsided playing field against people who have infinitely more scale than I do. And that is the kind of new and latest kind of like challenge to media. Because when you hit a certain tipping point, and this is the kind of the thing that will be most interesting over the next few years, if as a media buyer, as an advertiser, if you're spending 85% of your spend in two places, but for the 15% of your spend, you have to maintain media buying agencies and ad tech vendors and measurement companies, and then kind of have them all deal with this kind of archipelago of tiny audiences, none of whom do quite as good targeting as the 85%. There's a certain point at which you say, I might well be able to save money, substantial amounts of money, just by going 100% to the platforms.
So you think this is time to be actually be worried about the big four ad agencies and just say maybe they could fall in next 5 years?
The challenge, and we're seeing that already in terms of like the drop off in their numbers and the challenges of an already consolidated business that can't really consolidate much more. You've got one school of thought which says advertisers will always want someone else's throat to choke. They'll always want to have the kind of plausible deniability of being able to fire someone. And as such, these agencies are required. But on the other side of things, like the reason why you have a media buying agency is to handle a complexity that you don't want to have to handle yourself. If you're buying from two places and those places are calling on you directly and trying to build a direct advertiser relationship, as both Facebook and Google are, then what's the value of a media buying agency? I still think like creative agencies will still have a hugely important part to play, but the value of a large media buying agency starts to diminish. And that's going to be it's going to be very, very difficult for them to prove that they are a source of value versus just a source of cost. If this kind of trend towards platform domination continues, as it probably will.
Yeah, well, it couldn't have happened to nicer people, right? Because they are the reason all the innovation in the advertising and payment and subscription and media landscape has been stuck is because the advertising agencies did not want to change because it impacted their business models. And I kind of look at that and just say, like, yep, pretty much, you know, they got this coming. And thank God that they are under pressure. But I think the other, we are also seeing the media blame Facebook and Google again for taking over the market and actually not taking responsibility for their own actions. A lot of the reason, a lot of these media companies were very glad to sign up with Facebook to get the cheap traffic. And then now that, you know, they've lost the preeminent position with Facebook, which always does this to every partner. Like, it's not the first time they've screwed over somebody. This is like every single person who has partnered with them has gone away bruised and battered. And so why did the media companies think they would be any different? And now they're complaining about them controlling so much advertising market. My question to you is that if these two companies control 87% of the market by 2020, like, what's the impact of that on the media industry?
Well, I think like this is the reason why everyone is trying so hard to try and explore and understand new revenue models, which is that over the last 6 months, you've had very much a kind of sea change in perception. Because in the past, there was always a pivot to X that could show kind of bright light of the future. So there was a we're going to pivot towards native ads, or we're going to be the one that introduces these kind of fabulous native ads, and they're going to be how we differentiate ourselves from the people who sell boxes. Or we're going to pivot to video because video can be nicely distributed. You get high CPMs, and so that's going to be our source. So there was always kind of a kind of format based source of optimism within advertising, or even structural with programmatic. You know, we're going to like reduce our cost. It's going to be better targeted and so forth. And what's been interesting over the last 6 months is there isn't one of those anymore. There isn't a, if we just do this new format or change this structure, there's no, we can optimize our way out of this. There's a genuine kind of sense of ad revenue will continue to be important, but it will not be the source of growth for media that it has been in the past. And as such, we have to start thinking about direct consumer revenue. And this is a problem in some ways because for many publications, they have not spent time doing the kinds of things that you need if you're going to build a direct consumer revenue stream. The main one of it, which is kind of build brand affinity and trust and a certain amount of love. And it's very hard to do that when you're kind of battering someone with like interstitials and pre-rolls and kind of big bounced exchange things and serving clickbait. And so there's going to be some very rough times for people as they go forward and they try to see just how hard building a direct consumer revenue business is.
Well, the question I have for you then, if that is like, I think a lot of it is again on the industry itself. I remember the time when I would actually spend 50 cents on the New York Post every day when I would walk, get on the subway, going to the office. And then when in the office, I would have the office pay for New York Times and Wall Street Journal. So essentially, I was spending close to $3 a day on content, right? I was paying for it. And that's about roughly $90 a month.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. However, you know, at some point in their beautiful wisdom, they decided to give away, whether New York Post or New York Times, the content for free, and basically took away any reason for me to value the brand in terms of money, right? And I think that relationship cannot change for all the papers. Maybe the New York Times, you know, goes from 2 million subscribers to 5, but it doesn't necessarily mean it will happen for every other paper. It doesn't, you know, I don't know if I want to pay for USA Today. I mean, great paper as it might be, I've never really paid for it. I used to get it for free in the hotels, and then I used to read it for free on the internet. So why should I suddenly start paying for it? And I think that equation doesn't, you know, that reality hasn't entered the minds of people who run these big companies just yet.
I think there's definitely something true to what you're saying, in that there's kind of two things to be aware of in this space. One of which is that, in general, as you mentioned earlier, when you convert people who are kind of super fans to any kind of single site subscription, so whether it's a Business Insider has just launched its BI Prime, which is actually doing very well, or anything else like that, that is, your market is maybe your top 5%. You're likely to convert someone within your top 2% or so. And then you have to ask yourself, can I make enough from that top 2% to support the other 98% if they're not really bringing in that much in additional revenue? So there's challenges of economics and pricing at the level, and whether you can grow it. Because you see right now that if you look at the kind of the general papers out there, there's the Wall Street Journal, there's the WAPO, and there's the New York Times that have subscriptions in the millions. Then there's a couple of kind of metros, the LA Times and Boston Globe, they're in the kind of hundreds of thousands. And then below that, if you're a local metro newspaper, you're lucky to be getting like 20,000, 30,000 subs. And is that enough to run a local metro newsroom? I don't know. So you've got that as one kind of challenge, whether the economics will work when you're monetizing such a small percentage of your audience of superfans. But the second challenge, of course, with this is that the systemic impact of everyone moving towards this model at the same time. Yeah. So we've had media largely being something which didn't ask for direct consumer revenue, where that was something of a rarity. And now, yeah, I've been in pretty much every newsroom in New York and a bunch of others around the country over the last year. And everyone has either a membership or a subscription plan they're intending to launch this year. And the interesting thing is to think about what is the average number of subscriptions that a subscriber will hold. If you just put it out to the general population, the answer would be zero. But if you just tie it up to people who actually subscribe for news, what is the average number of subscriptions that they hold? And the answer is very likely to be one. And so if this increasingly becomes something of a zero-sum game, where you choose one particular publication to subscribe to, then one of the interesting possible impacts of this of this kind of industry-wide movement is that people might say, okay, you've persuaded me that I wish to get a, that I need to get a subscription for news. Which subscription should I get? I'll probably go for the one with the biggest value. Let's say that's the New York Times or the Washington Post. So it might well be that the impact of everyone else starting subscriptions is to actually increase subscriptions for the New York Times and Washington Post. And there's a great kind of like weird example of this, which is British Kit Kats. So in Britain, a Kit Kat is a very, very different form of chocolate. It's not whatever it is in America, which is kind of like a stale wafer wrapped in feces and soap. It's a beautiful, beautiful chocolate experience. And it's the number one selling chocolate in Britain. And they brought out a variety of different flavors. The first thing they brought out was a chocolate orange version of the Kit Kat. And the interesting thing was that total sales dropped. And this happened because before, people didn't consider the choice. They went in, their default behavior was just to grab a Kit Kat and go and pay for it and be done. And once they were given a choice, they were like, oh, well, I'm going to consider the Kit Kat. I'm going to consider the chocolate orange Kit Kat. I may well consider a Lion Bar or an Aero or something else. And so total sales dropped because they changed the mentality of the person as they're doing it. And so the interesting question for me is whether that same thing happens in media, whereas the mere act of getting someone into that position of choosing then makes them go for a different option than the one that you intended.
So how do you juxtapose that against, let's say, something like The Athletic, which just raised about $20 million, right?
Yeah.
And they are purely subscription-driven business. And I wonder if this is going to lead to more copycat businesses on subscription too.
So I think like there's one clear area where kind of niche focused subscriptions do very well. And you can put The Athletic in there. You can put The Stratechery in there above Avalon. There's a bunch of these things which do very well. And in general, they're not about news so much as they are about voice. There's a specific perspective and a specific voice that people care about and value. It's the same thing in some ways with Axios, which is probably the most successful of the latest breed of new media companies, where they were very, very clear that with politics, they have Mike Allen as the voice. With business, they have like Dan Primack. With technology, they have Innofried. So like they've got all of these different voices that people can connect with, and they want to hear that person's perspective. And that is actually an inherently valuable thing within media. People will pay because it's something that isn't commoditizable. You can't get Ben Thompson's voice on some other news site. You can only get it with Stratechery. And same thing with much of the work that The Athletic has been doing. And so there's clearly a business model around direct consumer revenue for kind of niche voice-oriented publications. The problem that we have as an industry is not that stuff. It's the news that is both commoditized and important. And by that, I mean, it is important that the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN all cover the Mueller investigation. There may not be a tremendous amount of difference between the reporting by those three organizations on that story, but it is important that they cover this. And so the challenge becomes, again, how do you kind of create revenue from content that is not voice-based, is not unique. In fact, its importance comes from the fact that it is in some way commoditized. And that's a very, very difficult challenge, which is different than the one that an Athletic or a Stratechery face.
I think the voice-based businesses are inherently not scalable. I'm having done one, and I can tell you it just is not feasible to get them to a point where they actually become big enterprises. You actually have to adapt and adopt some of the more mainstream media philosophies in order to scale up. I think, you know, we saw that with GigaOm, we saw that with TechCrunch. I think we were 15 years ahead of the curve on everything.
Sure.
We did the for pay services. I think there is just a finite amount of revenue which is out there. You think, I mean, you know, it's like I have a choice. Who do I pay? You know, Ben or Above Avalon or The Information? And it becomes really difficult for me to decide that I need two, not one, or three of these subscription services. I just need one. I need to listen to one person.
I think that's
true. And
then
I kind of make a choice, right? Like, and just like I made a choice, like I pay for Wall Street Journal. I'm not so sure if I will re-up my New York Times subscription.
Yeah, well, like, I think definitely the trend in subscriptions will be towards a zero-sum game. I think that is true. Where, as I said before, the average number of subscriptions that anyone has will be one. I would also say though that when you were doing kind of GigaOm and you built that, the cost structure was vastly different, and you weren't also going for subscriptions. You weren't getting people to pay $10 or $20 a month for that voice. And I think one of the things that with some of these new players coming in is they have a very, very low cost structure. It's basically kind of one person or and a few kind of costs associated with that. And then they have much, much higher ARPUs because they're taking a relatively small audience. They're not even trying for scale, and they're charging them a relatively high amount.
But that's exactly my point. Like, this is what I was saying is that, you know, when I was doing things on my own till 2006, from 2001 to 2006, scale wasn't what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just by myself, and it was running off first movable type and then WordPress. So the costs were zero. And so it made sense. But like the minute you try and do it as a company, it starts to become a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah,
I think that's where the voice-based media is. Like, they're no different than newsletters of the past. I remember paying for high-tech strategy by, you know, Fred Hickey, and it used to cost $500 a year or $600 a year. And and it was great and whatever. I mean, you know, people paid for, or, you know, Grant's Observer, man, people paid thousands of dollars for that thing. So it's clearly the voice-based publications are nothing different, right? Like, people still used to pay for them and they will keep paying for them. They're not publications, they're newsletters. And even with four or five reporters, they're still newsletters.
So this is, I think, yeah, I think they each has their own inherent issue of scale. I think the interesting thing that Axios is doing is that they are combining like individual channels of voice together into one larger company where the individual voices have the same amount of kind of brand presence as the larger company. And so it's in some ways, it's not a traditional publication in my eyes, so much as a series of these potentially very high margin, small scale on their own, but when put together starts to become an interesting media business. That's why I think of all the media companies out there right now, I think they are by far the most fascinating. And if I had to,
they're also 1 year old.
Sure, I mean, sure. There's a certain amount of there's a certain amount of jazz hands in the first couple of years about any publication.
Every baby looks cute in the first year. It's in the year 14 is when you start to see, oh my God.
Okay, yes. There is certainly time for them to go through their kind of pimply teenage years. But there's been a crop of kind of new startups over the years, and they're the first one that I've truly been like, wow, I wish I'd thought of that.
Well, how about you think about the fate of the current companies, you know, the BuzzFeeds and the Voxes of the world? I mean, they have taken like, you know, shiploads of money to grow their businesses. What happens to them?
So the good thing is they've all got like very good CEOs. Like Jim Bankoff, I think of as being the best media CEO in the business, and he's got a pretty fabulous team. I think they're clearly having to kind of weather some challenges and changes. There was a bet that was made, and this was a bet made by a whole ton of people, including Little Things and Rare.us, which is the kind of conservative site that shut down recently, around kind of like the monetization potential of social video, which didn't emerge. They made a bet, didn't work out. Like, that's life. That's the business of startups. So I think there's definitely kind of challenges and retrenchments in that perspective. They are like one of the things that is certainly true is that whilst a lot of these guys have raised a lot of money, they've often kind of kept a lot of money. This is as far as I'm aware, some of these players Vox, Jim Bankoff did a wrote about this, where he was talking about they had a very good year, they had a high margin year, and he's still got a ton of money in the bank. So even if someone like a Vox is kind of like having to kind of like change its business a little bit, is having to make new bets, like they've got a tremendous amount of kind of like cushion to be able to do that. The challenge would be if I was a media company that had raised money at a tremendously high valuation, was having to go through one of these retrenchments, and had already spent all of that money. Because I think one of the things that we're seeing is that you have certainly among the kind of VC community that I'm aware of, something of an antipathy towards both kind of media and even ad tech right now. And the challenges of being able to, and the challenges of being able to raise a large enough round of money at a kind of similar valuation to what I may have been given out before, could be very, very difficult. So I think if you're in this place and you're trying to go through a kind of retrenchment and a challenge to your business model, you definitely want to have a nice war chest.
Well, I think, you know, my view on this is that somebody like BuzzFeed actually clearly has the future in their hands, and they don't, you know, all they have to do is shut down everything except for their food stuff, you know, their food channel, food products, you know, their recipes and their, you know, the stuff they're making and selling on Amazon or wherever. that's their business. I think BuzzFeed could just be the Food Network 2.0 and still be a really good investment for people who backed the company so far.
Sure,
I'm not sure why they are chasing the page views and eyeballs on like the news and other stuff. I think they should just move on.
Yeah, this is the kind of interesting thing in that in Jonah Peretti, they've got a CEO who's kind of bold enough to do that kind of thing. I mean, if you think about the transitions that BuzzFeed have made, you had a site that originally started out where its predominant model was kind of native content on site, then moved to largely being a kind of social video service. You know, it's like 80% of its views were happening off-site. They were video and so forth. And now you've seen this kind of transition into new things where they're starting to sell kitchenware and all kinds of things. So they've shown remarkable facility, and Jonah has shown an ability to kind of like jump into a new space in quite a bold way. Like I had no idea they'd be selling cookware in Walmart. But it makes sense if you think of this as not a publication, but as a brand, and this is just a brand extension.
All right. This is just like how brands are starting their own publications. This is a publication starting its own product. It makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, I unfortunately, other people can't do this because, you know, they don't have that kind of, you know, like nimbleness around their model. I think my biggest challenge with the media industry, and, you know, I've been looking to invest in something in media, but I keep seeing the same wine in new bottles every single time. It's the same idea of media as a news, as magazines, as radio, as podcasts or TV shows on like, you know, on online. And I'm, you know, and very rarely do you actually come across a company which views media from the perspective of attention and values attention in a different sort of a way. So the way I think about media now is like we are in a zero sum game for attention, and we are competing as a traditional news company. You're competing with video games and Netflix and everybody like that in because you just cannot assume that people will give you the time of the day they used to give you. And so for me, I think the media industry is still so defined by the formats of the past and not of the future. I look at HQ Trivia and I just think, oh, that's an interesting idea, right? But it's still very similar to the idea which has been popular on the traditional media, you know, platforms like television. But it's interesting because it's completely independent of a specific network, and it creates a sense of appointment, you know, collaboration and community in this time when that doesn't exist, but it still sucks up attention. So if you're an advertiser, that's a really good place to throw your dollars, right?
Yeah. And I think that's, it's definitely true. And one of the challenges of the media industry is that too often we kind of think of people as being just like us. We think that they have this deep-seated connection to the news, and that they're hitting paywalls all the time. And the reality is actually very different, which is that for most people, consuming news is the thing they do when it's 2:50 p.m. and they have a meeting at 3, and they just want to do something for 10 minutes. And they often don't even know what site they're on because they're coming through Facebook. And it's kind of very casual behavior. And in that context, you're absolutely right that the fight for those 10 minutes is not between different news organizations. It's between a game. It's between some other form of entertainment. It's between a YouTube video and so forth. And this was actually a kind of an interesting conversation I had with someone at Facebook who's fairly junior. So this wasn't kind of like a kind of official thing, but they were just musing on like the problem that they've had with news and kind of fake news in the newsfeed, and whether they sh- would it be better if Facebook just kind of got rid of all news from the newsfeed? Would that make it like better for the news industry if they did? And where we came to was, no, it wouldn't, because it wouldn't be a necessary situation where those people in Facebook would then get out of Facebook and seek out the news elsewhere. They would just consume different things within Facebook. So where we came to was, Facebook still has to try and solve this incredibly hard problem of like how to get kind of real and good news out to people within Facebook. But knowing that the opportunity cost of consuming news isn't other news, it's whatever else can fill your attention in that moment.
So how are you thinking about the opportunity you have ahead of you as a founder? Tell me a little bit more about Scroll and what you guys are doing.
Sure. So the key thing for me is that I, like, in many ways, media is going through a kind of golden age of content creation. I mean, we've never had a more kind of crowded field for kind of Pulitzer-style journalism than we've had over the last year and a half, in part thanks to the disastrous administration that we're dealing with in the White House. So the problem is, for me, is not that it's not any shortage of formats. The problem is the business model and the structural challenges of the industry. And one of those structural challenges is that the way that we have made money around content has been by distracting people from that content. Literally the success of our business model has been, we can drive people here for it to do a job, and then we're going to try to do our best to stop them doing that job. And if we're very successful, we make more money. And that's been the kind of advertising-esque model of media recently, particularly on mobile, because it's not that advertising in and itself is bad. It's about the moment that you can choose to advertise with. Because if you're someone like a Google or even a kind of classic magazine, you could advertise at the moment of choice, which was when someone is choosing what to consume and they're like flipping through the pages and there's editorial content and there's commercial content and they can choose what to consume. The problem that we have with media today is that the only way to be able to put an ad in front of someone's face particularly on mobile, is to interrupt the thing that they're doing. It's no longer at the moment of choice, it's at the moment of interruption. And so there's a user experience challenge at the same time that we're trying to drive kind of like a better user relationship as we go. And at the same time, the money that we get from that business model is not going to be the revenue driver of the future. And so for me, the thing that I was always interested in was, how do you try and kind of change the kind of structural economics? How do you make it possible for you to align the idea of good user experience and the kind of revenue that can support a thriving free press? And so I joined together with two good friends of mine, one of whom had spent the last 10 years tackling this exact transition in the music industry, first in Universal Music and then at Spotify as their first VP of content. And then, quite frankly, the best engineer I've ever known, this guy called Kushal Dave. And we tried to like tackle the economic issue. So that's what Scroll is trying to do right now, which is we're trying to, and it's going to launch later this year. And basically what Scroll is that you pay us $5 a month. And wherever you go in premium media, and however you're getting there, so if you're going from Facebook to MSNBC, or you're on Twitter and there's an Atlantic article that you want to read, and you go to that place, when you get there, it's going to be clean, fast, it's going to be ad-free, it's going to be user experience just designed for the user. And then we take that money that you've given us and we distribute it to the publishers in a way that where they make more money than they would have from advertising. And so what we're trying to do is see if we can create a win-win situation where publishers get to compete on a better user experience versus a worse user experience.
So how far are you on your journey so far?
It changes by the day in terms of how I feel about it. So basically, we made a decision that there were kind of two ways in which you could go about this kind of service. You could create something kind of unsanctioned, try and get a bunch of users, and then use those users as leverage to persuade publishers to sign up. But we didn't think that was really something that was consistent or even the kind of ethical way to go. So instead, what we've been doing is we've been bringing the publishers together, we've been working with them on the model, spending a lot of time trying to see what are all the kind of the key points, and then getting to a place where they all feel comfortable kind of signing up on common terms. And we announced 2 weeks ago, in addition to another strategic investor. So we have the largest publishers in the world are investors in Scroll, whether it's the New York Times, it's Axel Springer in Europe, it's News Corp, and now Gannett, the kind of largest in the kind of local space, and also with USA Today, as you mentioned earlier. And we announced kind of deals in every major media category. So it's the first time anyone's ever been able to do this. There's never been a situation before where publishers have agreed to come together and offer clean, fast, beautiful, ad-free versions of their sites for one flat monthly price. And so we're excited about that. We've still got a long way to go to kind of get to that kind of critical mass of publishers before we launch later this year. We've made progress and done things that people thought were impossible. So we're pretty excited about where we're at.
So 2018, what's your prognosis and forecast for 2018? Media industry.
For the media, so there's a few things going to happen. Like advertising revenue is going to continue. It's like somewhat slow network decline. Now, some people are still going to do better, but the general decline will be there at the network level. Everyone's going to try and launch their membership subscriptions, and most of them will not work out. And that's going to be just from a kind of, it's a brand new business model. There's not been enough time with brand affinity, or just it's the wrong combination, or it's that zero sum game. So you'll have a few kind of winners coming through, but a lot of them will be kind of disappointing in their performance. And I think as we kind of go into 2019, a lot of publishers will be trying to work out like what the hell is next, or how do we become, or what do we have to do to really start thinking about our future. So I think 2019 is actually going to be a fascinating year as we see a kind of bifurcation in some ways between the publishers who've been able to make a direct consumer revenue model work and those that have not.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sorry we didn't get into any fights on this podcast. Maybe it's too early in the day for me.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Yeah. You're a fighter, man. I know that. Hey, good luck with Scroll. I hope you bring the change you want to desperately bring into the media industry. I'm sure, given your past history and your desire to write at the front end of the boat. What do you call the bow?
Yeah, the bowman. Oh. Yeah, the bow of the boat.
Yeah. I mean, that's essentially tells everything about you and how mad you are to try this. But if there is anyone I would say who can do this, it's you. So
thanks,
good luck, Tony. And thanks for taking the time and talking to me. This was fantastic.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. It was super fun.